You're listening to LawPod UK from the creators of the UK Human Rights Blog. It's a podcast that discusses developments across all aspects of civil and public law in the United Kingdom. All the comments are current at the time of podcast publication. LawPod UK is produced by the barristers at 1 Crown Office Row and is presented by Rosalind English.
I'm Rosalind English, and I'll be talking to Sarah Jane Newitt, who regularly writes for the UK Human Rights Blog, rounding up the latest news in the law. Just as this podcast was going to press, there were more developments on the question of women's rights to a termination of pregnancy in Northern Ireland. The Court of Appeal there has refused to rule on allowing rape victims to have abortions, saying that it is not up to the courts to decide on abortion law. Any reform, said the judges, should be left to the Stormont Assembly. And now more on this question and others with Sarah Jane Newitt. So let's start with some recent developments on cases we've covered in our podcasts. No one could have foreseen when the Northern Irish abortion case was being fought through the courts that the government would do a U-turn on the day of the Queen's speech. What was all that about?
I don't think anyone saw that coming. I know that we blogged extensively on the case as it was going through the courts, and we're expecting to see it go to the European Court of Human Rights, and we're all kind of gearing up for that. I mean, in brief, what happened was that the government U-turned completely unexpectedly because Conservative MPs had fallen in line behind an amendment by Stella Creasy, which said that it would provide Northern Irish women with access to free abortions in England. And then Theresa May essentially didn't want to risk a rebellion from her own MPs, obviously. In the much weakened state that she's in currently, that would have been a further risk. And so the U-turn went through. And it's just a really interesting example of a case where politics have been more effective than the law, and a lot faster.
And this is not the only occasion in which we've seen politics come in where the law has, as it were, left off, because although we reached the end of the case of the very ill baby Charlie Gard when the Strasbourg court ruled the case inadmissible, there have been political developments since then. But leaving those aside, Sarah Jane, can you just give us some sort of reflection on whether there are any lessons we can learn from this whole sorry saga?
It's a very difficult question, this, and it's been ongoing through a lot of twists and turns at this point, and I know that it's especially been extremely difficult for the family. And now, you know, we can hardly mention it without mentioning the Pope's involvement, with Trump's involvement. Everyone's kind of throwing their oar in, but it's been a really difficult case. And I think it's positive to note that the hospital is in no rush to make any decisions to change the treatment plan in the near future. And the parents have said that they're just enjoying the time that they have with Charlie, that just the time that they have left. And I think that that's, all of the legal developments aside, that case is left off.
Moving on, I recently wrote about the case of a transgender father who left the ultra-Orthodox Jewish community where he'd lived all his life and married and had 5 children. Earlier this year, he applied to the family courts for regular contact with his children and was refused. He's just been granted permission to appeal against this decision. Could you tell us a bit about the background to this case?
Yes, of course. This is actually a really interesting case, and it's essentially about an ultra-Orthodox Jewish trans woman who left the community in 2015 because she wanted to live openly in her gender. She was forced to leave behind a wife. Their marriage had broken down totally, and also their 5 children. And I think that life as a trans woman in the community had become completely unlivable for her. She'd been suicidal. She was unable to come out as trans. She said that life in the community was oppressive to the extent that she feared threats on her life. I mean, obviously this narrative is familiar for many trans people whose communities fail to accept them, right? But perhaps in such an isolated, hermetically sealed community as the ultra-Orthodox Jewish community, this was even more difficult. And the question for Mr. Justice Peter Jackson in the family court in January was whether contact between those children and their father would be in the children's best interests.
I think this is a very good, very interesting background to the case, but just to make the point that the father in this case, and indeed the mother, both parents, were at risk of
Absolutely.
Extremely hostile treatment. So not in a personal vindictive way, but because of the the laws and the customs of the ultra-Orthodox Jewish community known as the Haredi. There are about 50,000 ultra-Orthodox Jews in the United Kingdom, mainly congregating in North London and North Manchester, which is where the father is from in this case. Jewish law, derived from the Old Testament, governs behaviour in the realm of food, dress, education, speech, communal responsibility, everything. Access to television or any of the social media is not permitted. And needless to say, transgender is extremely alien to these communities and against religious law. And indeed, one of the rabbis giving evidence to the court in this case said that knowledge of transgender amongst children in the ultra-Orthodox Jewish community is almost non-existent. I mean, that's not surprising, given their lack of access to the media. There is no known precedent in the United Kingdom of a transgender person being accepted in an ultra-Orthodox community. So, returning to the arguments in the case, in that context, what were the father and mother's arguments?
The situation for both the father, the trans woman, and her family was particularly febrile. But in terms of their positions as opposed to their legal arguments, the father had argued that she should be sensitively reintroduced to her five children. She'd conceded that it was in their best interest to stay with their mother, but she had argued that they would be able to come to terms with her transition if they were given the proper support. And actually, the court did agree with that in principle, but it came to a different view about the best interest of the child, which I'll come to. As you say, none of this was malicious. I think Mr. Justice Peter Jackson said that he'd looked for malice in the mother's evidence, and he couldn't find any. She was just totally baffled by the concept of being trans, and she'd initially been opposed to contact, but then had agreed that there should be indirect contact a few times in a year. But ultimately her position was that direct contact during their childhoods would mean that she and the children would be ostracized from the community, from all that they'd ever known. But in any case, it's not really about the parents' arguments. I'll try and outline the legal framework that the judge was navigating. But so firstly, in terms of family law, the welfare of the children, as we know, is the paramount consideration, and that's Section 1(1) of the Children's Act 1989. There's also a rebuttable presumption that contact with with parents is in a child's best interests, unless the contrary is shown, or unless there are cogent reasons against contact, and that's Section 1(2), subsection A. And this is pretty much the crux of what the court had to agonise over, is whether or not contact in this case would have been in the children's best interests. In terms of other legislation, and what was relevant here was, of course, the European Convention of Human Rights. So you've got Article 9, which was freedom of thought and religion, Article 14, the right to freedom from discrimination, and obviously Article 8, the right to family life. Briefly, you've also got the Equality Act 2010, which makes it unlawful for a school to discriminate against a potential pupil. That's obviously more in terms of the welfare of the children with regards to their school. And then obviously you've got Section 6 of the Human Rights Act, which says that public authorities, including courts, can't act in a way which is incompatible with a convention right. But in practice, where parents and children have competing convention rights, the one which will prevail is, again, the rights of the children. So that's kind of what Mr. Justice Peter Jackson in January was trying to navigate.
In another context, possibly, the judge would have come to a different conclusion. But this one was very special on its facts.
Absolutely. I think this was pretty much unique. As you said, there's been no precedent in the UK of someone leaving, of a transgender person leaving even the community, let alone bringing proceedings about the community. So, yeah, this was pretty much all new, I think, to the courts, relatively untrodden ground.
So, obviously, there are very strong arguments in favour of direct contact, not least of all giving the children and their father the lifelong benefits of an irreplaceable relationship. What other factors did the father have on her side?
The effect on her, for one thing, at being forced to leave her community and losing contact with her children, this is a terrible loss, and Mr. Justice Peter Jackson did really struggle with it. He said that he found this a horribly troubling decision to have to make. I'm sure none of us would have liked to have to make it. But also just the broader conceptual argument of tolerance, of whether or not she should be allowed to see her children regardless of who she is or what anyone else might think, because this is a situation in which the law has denied her contact because of the intolerance of a minority community towards another minority community. And although we do see the legal arguments, especially in terms of family law and the welfare of the children that got us there, it's a difficult argument to condone. And I think for that reason, it would have been very very surprising if she hadn't been given the right of appeal. Actually, one of the reasons on the father's side, according to the judge, was that contact would give the children some small experience of the wider world and allow them to make decisions for themselves as they get older. And I think that that's also an important point. But yeah, a very difficult balancing act.
I think one of the most difficult but real problems that the judge faced was that if he'd made an order in favour of the father, it would have had so little effect in the ultra-Orthodox community as to amount to nothing. And therefore no such order was made. The trouble with this is, what kind of message does it say about the law and its dominion over other fundamentalist communities?
That's exactly right. And I'm sure you'd know more about this than I do in terms of the community, in terms of the specific reach into the community. But I would note that Mr. Justice Peter Jackson said that acceptance of the father by the community would take a great deal more than a court order in this case. And obviously that's true. You know, clearly there's a conflict here. And at one point as well, the mother says that in terms of admission to schools and the fact that her children might be discriminated against, she says, "I uphold the British law within our faith." And she also clearly faced a conflict here. She said if there's a conflict between the law and her faith, she would follow her faith, though she says she obviously wouldn't commit a crime. But then I suppose that argument fails if you consider discrimination on the scale to be a crime. And I think that that's where the difficulties came in for the court.
It's probably very unfair to ask you, but I'm going to ask you nevertheless, do you have any hunch as to which way the Court of Appeal will go when they hear the case in November?
I don't know, and you're right, it's a very difficult question. But as I say, I would have been very surprised if it wasn't given leave to appeal, though I don't yet know the arguments which will be made. But I think it's not extravagant to say that it might go all the way to the European Court of Human Rights. I think these are really, really contentious issues. I think in terms of family law, the argument was sound, and the only thing that might perhaps sway is if there's either a significant change of circumstances, which I don't think is particularly likely, or if the Article 8 rights of the father were found to be given insufficient weight in the first instance judgment. And I think on that point, it's actually worth noting that each parent called two informed witnesses to speak on the reaction of the community, or of the position of trans people in the community. I mean, non-existent as that is, but they both had rabbinical expertise. And yet there was something of an absence of experts on trans rights, which I would say is a potentially difficult vacuum, given the pains made to ensure that this wasn't a balancing act between the rights of trans people versus religious freedom, right? Mr. Justice Peter Jackson made it very clear that he wasn't subscribing to that dichotomy. He tried to say, you know, this outcome is not a failure to uphold transgender rights, still less a win for the community, more about the best interests of the child. And yet, I think one set of contentious issues was given a little more airtime, perhaps, than the other. And I wonder whether that's maybe symptomatic of a lack of weight accorded as a matter of law to those rights, and whether the outcome would be different in the Court of Appeal, or certainly whether it would be in the ECHR. But I have no idea. I will be very interested to see. And actually, on that, the appeal will be on November the 15th of this year, and scheduled to take a day. So we'll have to find out.
Of course, the children in this case will be a little bit older then. Not that that will make a huge difference, but things would have moved on.
Yeah, I wonder, because I know that out of the five of them, it's only the oldest son, am I right in saying that? It's only the oldest son who's fully aware of the situation with his father, the fact that she's trans, and the other four siblings either are too young to understand or haven't been told.
Well, interesting cases and all sorts of dilemmas. Thank you very much for coming on the podcast to discuss them with me, Sarah Jane, and look forward to speaking to you again.
No problem at all. I'll speak to you soon. Thank you very much, Rosalind.
LawPod UK is presented by Rosalind English and produced by One Crown Office Row. For more editions of LawPod UK, you can subscribe to the podcast on iTunes and recommend us to a friend.